Welcome to Politics Weekly. I'm Allegra Stratton.
And I'm Tom Clark, and we've got a top team with us today. We've the doyen of wise political comment, Martin Kettle, and the raciest of radical writers, Seamus Milne.
Good morning, both.
Hi.
Good morning.
This week, Northern Ireland stormed back into the news. A policeman was shot dead in County Armagh and two soldiers were killed outside an army base on Saturday. And it continues. Last night, security forces on both sides of the Irish border were hunting for a bomb after intelligence reports emerged that the real IRA had smuggled a large device into Northern Ireland from the south. Martin, we had an outbreak of party unity in the Commons yesterday. And to all intents and purposes, everything I'm hearing from the news reports is that we've had an outbreak of unity on the streets of Northern Ireland in condemning these attacks as well. Do you think everyone's in agreement almost there?
I think most people are, but I think it's quite dangerous to impose a narrative from London which says Northern Ireland is absolutely united and everything's going well in the political process, because I don't think that's entirely true. The roots of discontent and division are deep and have not gone away entirely, though obviously things are getting easier. There's some support for divisive action on both sides. Now, these shootings, I think, are part of something wider. There has been some disturbance in various parts of Northern Ireland, little bits, over the last few months. So there are, I think, signs that not everything is quite as kind of hegemonic for the peace process as the accounts here and the politicians here would like to suggest.
But Seamus, McGuinness calling the murderers traitors, will that be enough?
Well,
does it even ring true?
A very powerful statement.
Was it a shock when you heard him say it?
I think it was slightly more of a shock than saying about giving information to the police and all that stuff. But it's directly addresses the fact that these attacks are not just attacks on the British Army, but are attacks on Sinn Féin and their whole leadership of the Republican world and the Republican community. So it's not surprising in a way that they've reacted so strongly, but how they react. And I thought the original statement by Sinn Féin was incredibly carefully and effectively crafted, is a very difficult and sensitive one. I mean, so to pick up what Martin was saying, I think he's right that, you know, there is much more dissent than would appear. And I think that was clear in the reports from the Craigavon estate. You could see that.
So they look at McGuinness and they think you're the traitor.
Well, I'm not sure that most nationalists and Republicans do. I'm sure they don't. But there is obviously a significant minority that does. And it has a very powerful tradition to draw on, which, of course, McGuinness and Sinn Féin come from themselves. So, I think the real issue is whether or not this process is seen to be delivering enough and is to be seen to be moving forward enough to hold that ground. I mean, at the moment it has done. But, I mean, these are quite powerful challenges and we have to see whether that's possible.
Of course, so the challenge is the clampdown. What can Sinn Féin do? I mean, they were sort of all over this community, 10 years ago. Now they're part of a political process. What is their next step?
Well, they've got to be shown to be delivering some movement in the direction of the Republican tradition, the nationalist aspirations. Mm. And at the moment, it's one thing having jobs in the process, but it's quite another for people to see some prospect that there's some movement in the direction of what they want, which is the United Ireland. So there has to be more sign, I think, of cross-border cooperation and movement in that direction.
But how much harder, Martin, do you think it gets when people look at these remarkable pictures of McGuinness there, stood up next to Peter Robinson? People who are mainly in the mainstream, the Sinn Féin mainstream, not these kind of nutters, as we might call them, on the fringes, are they going to look at that and see him condemning the death of these British soldiers and then sort of say, this isn't what we're about?
I think some of them will think that, but most of them, I think, will think that McGuinness continues to represent them. There's going to be a very important test for this coming up in June with the European elections, which are always very important in Northern Ireland. And I think it's really, really a big test for Sinn Féin as to whether it continues to hold its essentially hegemonic position. Sorry to use the word twice already in this podcast.
Within
nationalist opinion, as it has built up over the past 10 or 15 years, or whether that begins to fray a bit. And the same, of course, is true in the South. So I think
I just ask where it would go? Where would nationalist opinion, because it's not going to go back to the SDLP if we're talking about militant, militant and angry Republican opinion. Are there significant parties we need to worry about which are further off the Republican spectrum than Sinn Féin?
Well, they haven't made themselves known yet, and what you might get, though we don't know, and this is pure speculation, is independent Republican candidates standing. That there is some tradition of that happening, and you know that is a possibility. And I think you should also look at the south of Ireland, because Sinn Féin, as a 32-county party, has an all-Ireland strategy. And again, if Sinn Féin's vote begins to fall in the south, I think then you might get greater tensions within Sinn Féin, within the Republican movement, perhaps more activity by the dissidents. So, you know, this is not an easy situation at all. It could unravel especially against a background of economic difficulties in Northern Ireland. It could begin to unravel over quite a long period. I'm not saying it will, but it certainly is a possibility.
I think that's right. I mean, the worst thing would be now is if British soldiers were seen back on the streets in Northern Ireland. I mean, that is the single most inflammatory.
How close to that?
Well, I mean, that's been what's been, you know, this whole series of events over the last few days, which started with the controversy over the undercover military units that were being called in by the police there. I mean, I think that is exactly, you know, the wrong direction to be going.
Seamus, do you see in the language used by McGuinness et al., do you see that they are less clear in their condemnation in the death of the soldiers than they are the death of the policemen?
You see, well, the murder word?
Yeah, the M word.
Yeah, well, they can't use that because they regard the British Army as an occupation army. And so, I mean, if they do that, then they're breaking with that core part of their constituency. So I think the way they calibrated it was...
14 hours to condemn the death.
Well, I mean, the way they calibrated it was very careful.
Long meeting.
Was very careful, and I think it was effective. I mean, it did the job that it was needed to do without pulling away from their own constituency. And if you look at the response, both in Northern Ireland and here, I mean, with the exception of, say, the Daily Telegraph and that kind of ultra-unionist cheerleading group, I think it hit the target, really.
I suppose the most important thing, in a way, is whether the Democratic Unionists go down the kind of Allegra path of asking these awkward questions about, you know, why aren't you using the murder word? Why aren't you condemning it?
But they didn't do that, did they?
They
rather strikingly didn't. Yeah. And I think at the moment, you know, the Democratic Unionists and Sinn Féin, amazing though it is, have got some kind of common interest, which is holding them together. I mean, there's nothing that the dissidents would like more than for the British Army to get back out on the street. That would obviously put the shim. Well, I mean, it's certainly a possibility. I mean, the more the more terror there is, the less easy it is for the police alone to handle it. I mean, it's and of course that kind of reaction is studied throughout British history in Ireland. That sort of overreaction is, of course, the best recruiting sergeant that the militants can ever have.
And there's a leader on this subject in the paper today. For those of you who want to read more, we've got a special report on developments at guardian.co.uk/UK/Northern Ireland. Well, the last time Northern Ireland was in the news, Gordon Brown was Chancellor, the city was booming, and the G20 was an obscure meeting of foreign leaders. Well, now we're 3 weeks away from a rather more important G20. Brown went to America last week to get Obama on board. But was he leading or was he following? John Stewart from The Daily Show was in no doubt.
At this defining moment in history.
So at this defining moment in history.
What we need is real change.
Change is essential.
It is that American spirit.
It's the essence of America's spirit.
All of us are going to have to work together.
Let us work together.
We have to seize the moment.
We should seize this moment.
What are you, a Barack Obama cover band? Gordon Hopefoot and the Yes We Can 5?
You think that was unfair with John Stewart?
Everything's fair. I think that Brown did well in America last week. For the first time, actually, since he became Prime Minister, he seemed to me to be comfortable and prime ministerial. I thought it was an impressive performance. I don't think he entirely brought it back to the Commons this week, but he wasn't bad at Prime Minister's questions. It was a rather unusual session.
But the worrying development is Gus O'Donnell, head of the civil service, caught at an obscure conference, but we've managed to get hold of his words, saying that they've been managing to get no decisions from the Obama administration. This is a sort of running theme now.
Well, I mean, the expectations have got completely out of control here. The government, the Brown government, has bet the farm on the G20 in terms of, not just of its important intrinsic importance to solving the economic crisis, but as the lifeline political safety for the Labour government. And, you know, immense amount has been invested in that, and the bar's been set extremely high, mainly by Gordon Brown, less so, I think, by others, but certainly by Gordon Brown. And he may come to rue this, because clearly the G20 is highly problematic. It's far from unified. It's far from agreed on a strategy. It's only going to last a few hours.
It's going to cost £50 million.
It is not the remaking of the world that Brown rather made it out to be. And I think this could it's obvious ammunition.
It's mainly an opportunity for Barack Obama to meet a lot of foreign leaders, isn't it? Very quickly in one place.
Speed dating.
But isn't there a bit of a difference here with previous big financial meetings? I'm thinking about the Battle of Seattle and so on, with people outside on the streets protesting. Aren't we all on the same side this time? Doesn't everyone want this meeting to succeed, unlike with WTO meetings and so on? Does that increase the likelihood, Seamus?
Well, there is going to be a lot of protest on the streets. I mean, and a vast array of different issues are being pumped in, both from NGOs, the anti-war movement, and so on. So I don't think that it's probably not going to be on the scale of Seattle. But, it's going to be big, I think, by the sound of it. I don't think they are all on the same side. I don't think we are all on the same side. I mean, within the G20, I mean, it's very important because it brings together not just the core Western economic nations, but China, India, and so on. There are crucial divisions, first of all, about whether to focus on regulation or reflation, with the Obama administration pressing for a bigger reflationary package across the world, the European Union mostly pressing in the direction of more regulation of financial institutions, and then, of course, the other parts of the world not really having the resources to go for much more reflation, and not necessarily being locked into the regulationary issues. So, I mean, it's how often are serious, breakthrough issues decided at summits? Almost never. So I think Martin's obviously right that it's the pre-sell of it has been ridiculous, and will be disappointed.
But to what extent? What Gus was talking about was, why am I using his first name? I don't know. O'Donnell was talking.
Gus. Yeah, exactly.
He was sort of making a point, or the defences, he was making a point about the fact that in America you have this flux of civil servants, or whatever they're called, whereas in here you have the continuity. So he's sort of bragging about the British civil service. But to what extent would Obama be delivering? If they'd been in place for 3 years, to what extent is it an excuse that they'd have hardly any people?
Well, I think it's a real problem that, there's only Timothy Geithner who's been approved and is in even been nominated. I mean, there are several key decision makers who, we just don't know who they're going to be, and that is that's obviously a problem when you're doing something pretty much on the hoof, as is happening now. I mean, there is perhaps one part of the unrealistic expectation has been the idea that an entire new American administration can hit the ground running and be able to take clear cut policy choices, especially on big strategic questions, as it's being invited to do by the British and others, within 3 months of coming into office. I mean, that just is, that's a really, really hard ask, even in a crisis like this. Having said that, I mean, I think, sure, there'll be some protests on the street. I bet the biggest crowds are to see Obama. I mean, I think, I think it'll be the star power is that will be the big thing. And I mean, he will be inevitably the center of all the coverage. And not just because of his star quality and glamour, but also because he is the person who has the decision. Whose decisions matter most, and so that dislocation between the unpreparedness of the administration and the overwhelming centrality of American decision making is a real problem.
So, Seamus, what's the morning after like? Nothing happens. The communique is a damp squib. How damaging does that become?
I don't think it does very, very much, because I don't think that most people, from a political point of view, are on top of the detail of the issues of regulation or the extent of inflation or what kind of international financial regulation there should be, this kind of stuff. So it doesn't seem to me that the political impact need be particularly negative for Brown and the government at all. On the contrary, I mean, just being seen as being a world player, you know, back in touch with his friend Barack, I mean, that seems to me a small but significant boost for the government.
Isn't there one other thing that it's quite plausible he'll get out of it, even if it isn't a detailed deal, which is that Barack Obama's going to stand up and make Gordon Brown's overdraft look respectable. He's going to say, we've all got to borrow, we're in this together. And that's going to help Gordon Brown a great deal.
I mean, it seems to me it's certainly helpful against the sort of main Tory attack on the government over debt. And I mean, you know, the fact that Barack Obama is heading down the same kind of road as the British government started on last autumn is mildly helpful, I would have thought.
Yeah, but the difference between the two overdrafts, as you put it, Tom, I mean, is stupendous. I mean, the fiscal stimulus in the United States is what? It's either seven times higher, I think, or maybe more than it is than in this country pro rata. So I mean, it is stonkingly large. I think though that
easier for them to finance their deficit, of course.
Well, that's right, yeah. And I think you know, it's a different political cycle, and you know, I think you know, Brown will get some. Bounce, if you want to call it that, out of the G20. It will be limited. I think he is performing quite well at the moment after a pretty rocky period in January and February. And, you know, it could be, I think, quite positive for him.
Will it be a precursor to increasing our own fiscal stimulus?
Probably. Yeah, probably a bit. But out there in Britain, I think there is a lot of anxiety about the debt. I think that really does, you know, that Tory attack shouldn't be just dismissed as a Tory attack. I think it's something people worry about. You know, the big lesson of this entire episode is about debt and overborrowing, and that is what the government is doing.
Well, the
political sale, you know, on that is a hard one.
I mean, the Tory success has been to blur the lines between personal debt and government debt, and I mean, actually, in the position we're in, it's quite a dangerous obfuscation to make, because it undermines the capacity of the government to do what's necessary.
Okay, well, there'll be more on this when Tom and I do a special on the G20 the day after the big event. That's the 3rd of April.
In the state that we're in at the moment, it's the bankers, of course, who are the bad guys. But 25 years ago, the bogeyman was not Fred the Shred, but Arthur Scargill. The government and the workers were locked in bitter and violent dispute over plans to close the pits. Our very own David Henke has written a book on the subject, Marching to the Front Line. He told us of the significance of these events.
The defeat of the miners 25 years ago basically is a total watershed moment in British politics. It means the end of the role of the unions. It allowed Thatcher and Blair, when he came into government, to actually run the country with only minimal consultations with the workers. Before that, basically nothing could be done without beer and sandwiches in Number 10. 25 years later, we're also in a dramatic moment in history, because basically the system set up, which allowed the free reign of capitalism, has now collapsed, with billions of pounds going into the banks to keep them going. People are starting to say, well, weren't they some good things, like the state running things and providing a proper safety net for people, that we've somehow forgotten about?
Martin, is David getting overexcited? Was it really that big a deal?
David, overexcited. I think the miners' strike was a massive event. And, you know, of course, if you lived through it, and, you know, I was a journalist then as well, and, you know, if you lived through it, it was a huge, huge, compelling, all-absorbing thing, and it went on for such a long time that, you know, it was impossible to be neutral, it was impossible to be, it was difficult to be objective. There were such compelling narratives, human tragedies, and so on. But its impact, I think, was that it changed the Labour Party fundamentally. I mean, I think that's the big thing that happened. I think that, in a sense, Arthur Scargill, wholly unintentionally, was the midwife of New Labour, because the miners' strike wasn't just simply a moment at which unions became the end of an era for the unions. I think it was also the question of violence, the question of, you know, having to appeal outside of the traditional Labour heartlands, the difficulties of that. All of that, I think, you know, is essential to the kind of to conditioning the new Labour approach. I mean, I would disagree with. I mean, I think David rather implies that it sort of allowed a kind of conspiratorially centrist Labour agenda to come through. I think it necessitated a centralist, centrist Labour agenda to come through.
It's a sort of counterfactual, maybe, but if there had been a victory, what would be different now?
Well, I mean, to slightly play devil's advocate, because I wrote this morning that it was a tipping point. I mean, I think we can slightly overdo this because, you know, Thatcher had been in power for several years when the miners' strike took place. A lot of these processes had already taken place. I mean, I would see the miners' strike as a last-ditch attempt by the core of the Labour movement to halt that process. And if it had succeeded, you know, it's hard to know exactly what the fallout would have been because it depends how it would have happened, what kind of settlement. But I think at the very least, it would have reined in the worst excesses of Thatcherism. It would have slowed down a lot the processes that Martin's been talking about in the Labour Party and the creation of New Labour. And it would have, you know, halted some of the worst aspects of neoliberalism as it was implemented in Britain. I mean, of course, the forces
that... desirable, is it?
Of course, it's desirable from my point of view. I mean, from the point, you know, I mean, there were much bigger forces at play, and they weren't just in Britain, they were all over the world. So, I mean, the neoliberal order would have still been established in Britain, but it would have been done in a different way. I mean, if you look at, you know, Germany and France and Britain, they're all, it was implemented in different ways in all those countries. And so, you know, it wasn't inevitable that the outcome of the miners' strike was what it was. And if it had been different, I think the situation would have been preferable from the point of view of most people in this country. But anyway, I just wanted to slightly correct the idea that if everything hinged on that. I don't think that's the case, but it is true that it was a last-ditch attempt to stop that process, and the fact that the outcome was what it was meant that the core of the Labour movement was broken, and that it was much easier to force through a lot of changes than it would have been otherwise.
But union membership was already sort of going down, hasn't
exactly,
it,
been
for
yeah,
a few
exactly.
years.
And there have been a number of other sort of, you know, symbolic disputes, steel workers, print workers, which had already taken place. I mean, there'd been other setbacks already. And, of course, the onset of privatisation and the general kind of neoliberal tide was already flowing pretty heavily. And it was quite late in the day when the miners' strike took place.
I agree with quite a lot of that. And I think it's important to see now, you know, that you look back at the general elections and the political decisions made in Britain over the period, let's say, mid-60s through to the mid-80s. And really, pretty much every general election, in one way or another, was shaped by the question of unions. From 1970, certainly 1974, certainly 1979, and... to some extent, though less perhaps so, 1983. But after that, I think that, you know, the question of the power of the unions is no longer central in British politics. It's a factor,
it's quite central and Labour politics,
and it remains the kind of elephant in the room for Labour politics for quite a long time, even today.
Labour
ceased to follow the. Ceased to have those kind of umbilical links with the TUC, with the General Council, which became much less important. You know, one of the key things about the miners' strike is that the TUC absolutely didn't deliver for the miners, although it said it was going to.
But as David Henke hinted there at the end, you know, if capitalism is now collapsing, could that mean that we're about to see a resurgence of trade unionism or some new form of it? Do either of you think?
Well, I wish it was true. I mean, I would be very much in favour of that. But I mean, a different kind of trade unionism. You know, I think the big thing that this country lacks is a sense of co-determination in workplace and company management along the German model. That's always been the great failure, I think. This has been seen by the left in the unions as collaboration and, you know, an attempt to preempt a socialist workers controlled outcome. I mean, I'm talking about the 1960s and 1970s, the response to the Bullock report preeminently. And, you know, I think there is a you know, I would like to think there was some opportunity for that agenda to be resuscitated. Whether it'll happen is another matter altogether. And by the way, just one more thing is, I don't think capitalism has collapsed. I think it's that capitalism is in crisis, but I think we may well find it where we all die under capitalism.
On that cheery note, we have to wrap up. That's it for today. Remember to visit Guardian website for more political fuel. Leave us your comments on the politics blog as well.
Thanks to our guests Martin Kettle and Seamus Milne, and to our producer Francesca Panetta. Until next week, goodbye.